Hey, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. We are already back with a new episode, as I mentioned in the last podcast with Robbie Martin. I'm hoping to put out more episodes this month because of health issues that kept me from podcasting most of May and part of April. Since I'm playing catch up a little bit with this podcast, I've been looking to cover some major events that took place while I was away. In addition to what I discussed with Robbie in the last podcast, I've also been eager to cover the relatively sudden pivot regarding the attention now being given by mainstream media and some alternative media outlets to the lab leak theory, and more broadly, the possibility that the origins of COVID-19 could be related to gain-of-function experimentation. After aggressively censoring such discussion throughout last year, something has obviously shifted in recent months, raising the question as to why and why now. Of course, in discussing such theories, the Wuhan Institute of Virology has figured prominently for obvious reasons. However, despite now being recently deemed safe, quote-unquote safe, to discuss in mainstream and some independent media circles, a few have tackled the considerable involvement at the Wuhan lab of U.S. government entities or funding, or the possibility that the breaches last year at the U.S.'s biosafety level 4 lab at Fort Detrick, Maryland, could have played a role in the origins of the condition. To discuss this and more, I am joined today by Sam Husseini. Sam is a Maryland-based journalist and artist who has written for Counterpunch, Anti-War, The Nation, Salon, Consortium News, Fair, and most recently, Independent Science News. Sam has been one of the few journalists of his caliber that has been willing to tackle gain-of-function research as a topic and dual-use biowarfare biodefense research in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis in a nonpartisan manner. So great to have you on the podcast, Sam. How are you doing?
Very well. It's wonderful to be with you. It's an honor, Whitney. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I'd like to start by asking you about your initial impressions of this recent shift around the plausibility of the lab leak theory and the mainstream attention now being given to the gain of function issue. So why do you think the shift has taken place and why do you think it's happening now?
I think there are two reasons for it. They're both kind of insidious, one more subtly than the other. One reason is that more scientists are speaking out. There were some scientists who, you know, would not say a word, until, relatively recently, even turning down questions, about it at news conferences and so on, the possibility of, lab origin. So that's sort of one thread, and I think that it's somewhat of an indictment, this whole story, somewhat of an indictment of the establishment science, not just the people who, you know, put out the false narrative that a lab origin is a conspiracy theory, but also those that were silent through much of last year and into this year. The other strand, which is more obviously nefarious, is that it's being pushed by, and might be related actually to the first thing, is that it's being pushed by, spooks, in conjunction with the Biden administration. I mean, this story really got going with a Wall Street Journal article, making allegations about, workers at the, Wuhan Institute of Virology getting COVID-like symptoms earlier than the outbreak had been previously documented. This is all anonymous. It may or may not be true, of course, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But that's really what sort of, you know, got this more prominently, genuinely prominently on the agenda, as well as the Biden administration saying, yeah, we're gonna look at this. And Fauci has, you know, kind of totally changed his line from dismissing things to saying, oh yeah, we need to look at this, and pretending that he hadn't been dismissing it in the manner that he was. So it's a huge, I guess you'd say, gaslighting exercise going on. So I think that those are the main two reasons that it's sort of getting to, you know, some attention now. But the attention is extremely constrained. First off, I should say at the top, I try to avoid using the term lab leak. I say lab origin. Lab leak implies it's an accident, which it may well have been. There's a long history of, you know, accidental releases from labs. But I think it's more accurate to say lab origin and to take this step by step. I think a year spent dismissing the possibility of any kind of lab origin accident, you know, including accident, has now shifted to pretending that accident is the only possible form of lab origin.
Mm-hmm.
There are obvious precursors for intentional release of lab agents. We just need to be systematic about it. And virtually all the current coverage is not at all systematic about it.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's interesting what you brought up about the potential involvement of spooks and similar figures in pushing this narrative or this shift in the narrative more recently. Because actually back in January 2020, I wrote about how the first claims that were asserting that COVID-19 was a Chinese bioweapon that had come from the Wuhan Institute of Virology had originally been circulated by Radio Free Asia, which of course is a U.S. government funded outlet previously in its earlier history run directly by the CIA, but now run by the State Department and the Broadcasting Board of Governors. And the second individual that was promoting those claims was an individual named Danny Shoham, who's an ex-IDF high-ranking doctor who had previously blamed Saddam Hussein for weapons of mass destruction and anthrax, I believe, in the aftermath of the anthrax attacks. So I remember reading that apparently the author of this more recent Wall Street Journal article you had referred to, it also had some similar history regarding blaming Saddam Hussein for various things. But I haven't checked that out for myself, but that certainly would be pretty telling if that was the case. And of course, one thing that has been pretty much avoided is something in terms of this narrative and the Wuhan Institute of Virology is the involvement of U.S. government funding there. And to an extent, it has been covered by some outlets, but just in the context of really Anthony Fauci's involvement in some of that funding or NIH funding specifically, not in the funding given to that institute by other U.S. government entities. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you about last year and how the climate of censorship before the sudden shift saying it's suddenly okay now, how did that affect your ability to write on the topics of gain of function, biowarfare, and biodefense dual use research labs last year?
I'd love to answer that, but let me just dovetail on your comments on the Wall Street Journal thing.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. That Wall Street Journal piece had a fascinating byline. It was Michael Gordon, who was a co-author of many of the pieces with the infamous Judy Miller.
Yes, I think that was part of what I had heard. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Right, and some sectors on the left have acknowledged that, particularly people who don't want to look at lab origin at all. And it's certainly a legitimate point. I don't begrudge that. The other part of one of the other people on that byline was Warren Sobel, who was on the other side within the, you know, establishment media circles. He was at Knight Ridder. And of course, they had, you know, a bona fide whistleblower at the Pentagon saying that the WMD case was being fabricated. So it was a very notable mix of bylines.
Oh, interesting.
Going in there, yeah. But the other thing with Gordon is that in some of his interviews, it seems to be attributed to a third country. And he hasn't said what the third country is. That's the source for this anonymous alleged information about workers at the Wuhan Institute of Virology getting sick. But he has said in the course of an interview, we sometimes trust third country sources like Israel. Now, he didn't say that this source in this case was Israel, but he actually brought up Israel as a trustworthy source.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you said, Israel has been pushing this narrative from Israeli allied sources have pushed this narrative from the front, from the start, which is certainly one more reason to be extremely careful and extremely cautious about it. But it seems to be in the background still.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Interesting point there. But, I do want to clarify, too, the reason I brought up the involvement of Radio Free Asia and and this ex-IDF guy, Danny Shoham, isn't because I discount the idea of it potentially being some sort of lab origin pathogen or anything like that, but mainly because I think there was a vested interest in pushing that narrative, and I think that same narrative is now potentially being pushed again, at least specifically by people on the right, sort of as a way of saying, oh, this was all, the Chinese government, despite the fact that we know that there was a lot of involvement from the U.S. And a lot of collaboration in Wuhan, not just at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, but a biosafety level 3 lab also in Wuhan that's directly partnered with Fort Detrick and things like that. But we can all get to that later because we do have plenty to discuss today. So I just wanted to return to my previous question about how the censorship last year affected your ability to write on these topics, if that's okay.
Sure. Well, I mean, the censorship was horrible generally. and it was, an incredibly horrid experience for me personally. I could see, it started with me that the CDC had a news conference on February 11th at the National Press Club. And I actually asked then, is it a complete coincidence that this outbreak happens in Wuhan, the one city in China with a declared BSL-4 lab, which, deals with the most deadly pathogens? And I also asked about the dangers of gain-of-function, so-called gain-of-function research, that is the creation in laboratories of potentially pandemic pathogens. And I was struck by the disingenuous response of the CDC official. So I feel like I kind of laid out in that Q&A the basic crux of the issue. I was alerted to this issue from Francis Boyle. He sent me an email, I believe before Tom Cotton, brought this up and helped the right wing own this issue. Francis sent me an email in late January saying, somebody should really check if there's a lab in Wuhan. And then, and I didn't bother checking. And then the next day, he sent me another email that said, bingo, there is a lab in Wuhan.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. And so I started sort of paying attention to this. Francis Boyle is a professor at the University of Illinois. He wrote the implementing legislation for the Biowarfare Convention, that prohibits that kind of work. And he argues that the U.S. is effectively, and all of these labs, U.S. or otherwise, are effectively violating the Biowarfare Convention.
Mm-hmm.
We can get to that. Anyway, so that's how I got into it. I put that question out there. It was completely ignored. And then the Lancet letter came out, orchestrated by Peter Daszak of the EcoHealth Alliance, branding the notion of lab origin a conspiracy theory, further silencing everybody. And then the Nature Medicine article came out saying that they had determined that lab origin was not a possibility. Meryl Nass at that point, who runs the Anthrax vaccine blog, said this article is BS. This Nature Medicine article, it doesn't even pretend to look at other forms other than crude genetic engineering techniques and how it could come out of a lab. And then I passed that to Richard Ebright, who's widely regarded as an eminent scientist at Rutgers University, who has been outspoken in his warnings about the dangers of some of this biolab work. And he said, you could imagine serial passage and other techniques, which had been causing concern in scientific and media circles over the last decade, at least, when they made the avian flu more easily transmissible, NIH-funded scientists in the Netherlands and University of Wisconsin. Anyway, so here it was, this story, this piece in Nature Medicine was clearly fallacious and was dominating the media coverage. And I knew that. and I was trying to get that information out, and I knocked on a lot of media doors of a lot of media organizations that I had a very long relationship with, and none of them wanted to touch it. And that helped the right own the issue, so that it became an issue of China bashing and not an issue of let's look at bio dangerous lab work.
Yeah, absolutely. It became very politicized almost right away.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, Peter Daszak and company were trying to politicize it from day one.
Right.
But there was a period between when that Nature Medicine article came out, and what I knew would happen and what I was trying to stop from happening was that I knew Trump would say something about it. And then that would completely calcify the issue. So I was desperate in those, you know, several weeks trying to get the information out. And I should say Meryl Nass, you know, did her, you know, posted a couple blog entries and so on about it. Anyway, so, so finally, unfortunately, Fox, I think, asked Trump about it, and he embraced the possibility of lab origin. And of course, that then the political, you know, atmosphere was completely calcified. Ironically, that day, Salon finally got back to me and said, yeah, we want a piece, which, you know, to their credit, you know, because everybody else, that made them more calcified. To Salon, it suddenly became a story. So that was how I got my first major article, you know, sort of, you know, looking at this. And I should say, part of the problem with the current thing, as Richard Ebright and others will note, is there's very little new data. The sudden fashionableness of lab origin is not based on any, you know, provable new scientific revelations.
Right.
It's basically been sitting there for a year. There are a few, but it's quite minor. So these have been political decisions, political calculations, because of the posture towards Trump, because of the power of much of the U.S. government, scientific establishment to try to bottle this up. And now the Biden administration can, you know, sort of use this against China in a slightly more subtle way than, you know, Trump's knuckle dragging manner. So it's been incredibly difficult for me personally to get information out. I mean, and because now that it's fashionable, you know, it's everybody's using it for their own political ends. There's virtually no media space for someone actually, you know, as Robert Perry, the founder of Consortium News, loved to say, I don't care what the truth is. I just care what the truth is. You know, I'm not trying to come at this with a political axe to grind. I'm just trying to figure out what the facts are. And there's very little media space for that kind of attitude at this point, even among, you know, presumably independent progressive media.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I have my own experiences with that as well, which I definitely think is unfortunate. But I think a lot of it, well, maybe not for every independent media outlet, but I think for some during this period, it had to do with concerns about getting censored on social media, losing social media accounts, which accounted for a considerable amount of their reach because they don't have the same resources as mainstream media do to reach an audience. At least that's what, you know, I heard through my connections from people at different outlets that chose not to cover this particular topic and still haven't, but, you know.
Yeah, I think that's true for some outlets. I'm pretty sure that's true of Mint Press, for example. But, I mean, I talked to them, but... You know, the other thing is, which I empathize with. I mean, I mean, I should confess. I mean, I didn't do a lot on Twitter on lab origin for fear of being deplatformed. So, you know, I'm a little bit culpable there. I could have tried to get this stuff out through Twitter. I thought, and I think probably correctly, that I would immediately deplatformed and I wouldn't be doing anybody any good by doing that. But I mean, there were outlets, you know, the Nation, Gray Zone, that were on the other side explicitly, you know, dismissing lab origin as a conspiracy theory. They totally, well, Democracy Now! Was horrid. They brought Peter Daszak on after Trump spoke about it and said, oh, Mr. Daszak, you know, Dr. Daszak, probably, you know, these people in Wuhan. This couldn't have happened, right? Absolutely not. This is a total conspiracy theory. What a nutcase Trump is. Let's be rid of him. You know, that was the, you know, what passed for independent journalism.
Right. Well, I think even now that there's been this shift, even outlets like Democracy Now, maybe I'm mistaken, but I haven't really seen any buzz about them covering this topic. And I kind of doubt they will.
Yeah, just a couple of little headlines or something.
Right. So since you brought up Peter Daszak, we might as well move along to discuss a little bit about EcoHealth Alliance.
Sure.
So I'm talking about this current narrative shift, and we mentioned a little earlier about some of what's been left out of this new narrative on the potential origins of COVID-19 and the potential role that gain-of-function may play in that. And of course, the Wuhan Institute of Virology had a partnership. Strategic partnership is listed on their website with EcoHealth Alliance. And of course, EcoHealth Alliance NIH funding in the earlier part of last year was suspended over this whole scenario that you're describing with Trump's initial comments and, you know, Peter Daszak's own personal pushback on Democracy Now, among other places, and they were cast kind of in a sympathetic light. But then you came a couple months later and reported on the hidden funding that EcoHealth or hidden in the sense that they've tried to hide it or obfuscate it to the greatest extent possible, that in contrast to the amount of funding they receive from the NIH, they receive most of their funding actually from the U.S. Department of Defense, from the Pentagon, specifically, I believe, the DTRA, which is involved in sort of this dual-use biodefense, biowarfare funding, both in the U.S. and abroad to a significant degree. And also, of course, significant amounts of funding from EcoHealth Alliance come from USAID or USAID, which has been called out for years by, independent journalists I consider really credible, like Mark Ames, as a CIA cutout. And the evidence certainly points there. So if you wouldn't mind sort of expanding on, EcoHealth Alliance, their funding, why it's relevant, why Peter Daszak is not exactly an honest broker, or rather an uninterested party when it comes to this topic.
Right. The role that Daszak played has just been incredible. I mean, he funded the lab in Wuhan. Then he was out in front, and Transparency Group U.S. Right to Know did a FOIA, which confirmed what I and other people suspected, that he organized the Lancet letter in February, deeming lab origin as a conspiracy theory. And the emails that they found, you know, actually had him saying, this can't appear to be a political document. You know, I mean, he was very conscious and recent emails from the Post and BuzzFeed, which may well be a limited hangout, have him, thanking Fauci for dismissing lab origin as a possibility. So he's out there, screaming that this couldn't possibly have anything to do with a lab. And then he ends up being put on both the WHO Origins Committee and the Lancet Committee on Origins, which was overall headed by Jeffrey Sachs. I, of course, emailed Sachs and said, about this obvious conflict of interest? I've been in peripheral contact with Sachs in the past, and of course, he didn't respond. So in the course of all of this, several people were looking at his funding. I got a tip from an anonymous account on Twitter. A lot of this work has been done by, people on Twitter who are anonymous and have managed to keep their accounts, as well as the good folks at Organic Consumers Association have done some very strong work in this regard. Alexis, terrible with last names, Vattermeyer. And so I sort of bottom lined Daszak's funding, EcoHealth Alliance. It's actually USAID actually gets EcoHealth Alliance more than the Pentagon.
My mistake.
Mm-hmm. They're actually bigger. It's been interesting to see how, like, Vanity Fair recently had a piece about the internal State Department deliberations regarding lab origin. There is not a word in that article about the fact that the State Department / USAID is the main funder for a lot of this dangerous lab work. So I think that that whole part of the equation continues to be outright ignored and kind of insidiously ignored. But we went through all the government databases. Of course, EcoHealth Alliance wouldn't, give all any of their financial information. And actually, on their webpage, they completely obscure it. They mention that they get Pentagon funding at the bottom of their privacy page. After they list the U.S., Fish and Wildlife Service, which they get, like $77,000 from. They get far, far, far more money from the Pentagon than they do from the NIH, and even more money from USAID. What's particularly interesting about the NIH cutoff that Trump did was that there was a letter put out by a bunch of Nobel Prize winners denouncing this move. And so what the heck are, all of these Nobel Prize winners doing, getting their business effectively defending EcoHealth Alliance, which any of them who are minimally literate must know is engaging in a non-scientific endeavor by saying that lab origin is a conspiracy theory, when there had been numerous warnings in scientific literature, in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, in other places before the pandemic, about the possibility of lab origin. What are all of these Nobel, like, I don't know, 70 or 100 Nobel Prize winners getting involved in this? Well, part of the mechanism of this seems to be corporate interests, because you had a similar letter several years ago attacking people who were scrutinizing GMOs. So there seems to be this, corporate and or government mechanism that gets these Nobel Prize winners to chime in at critical times during a scientific debate.
Seems likely.
part of the, I don't know if you saw the recent Jon Stewart rant on lab origins.
I heard of it, but didn't watch it. Yeah. But you're welcome to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just that, he effectively ends up blaming science, I can kind of understand the compulsion. He basically adopts lab origin and makes it, as an accident lab leak. But he, the whole notion of blaming science rather than the political economy of science, rather than the science, big science as we have it now, that is military funded, that is funded by spooks, that is basically molded by apparatchiks like Fauci, who's been a longtime proponent of gain of function, the creation of potentially pandemic pathogens work, who has attempted to shut up scientists when they objected to this kind of emphasis in terms of funding priorities and so on. So I think that what we're going to be seeing is this sort of debate between, corrupt big science and, kind of a complete Ludditism, which is a very bad setup. I mean, Fauci and Daszak are to science what, Oral Roberts and Jerry Falwell are to religion.
Fauci kind of made that clear.
You can't let them own the concept of, alleged scientific principles of looking at evidence and being logical. And I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. I just like that you made that analogy, because relatively recently, Fauci basically said, for all intents and purposes, said, an attack on me is an attack on science.
Huh. I didn't
Which is, sort of like a religious-esque approach to it. Yeah. So it is a very apt metaphor.
Yeah, it totally is large parts of our society have substituted white lab coats for black priest's robes as these reverential figures, rather than embracing science as to what it really is, applying reason and evidence and looking at evidence. That's what science is supposed to be about. Instead, it's become this complete appeal to authority in conjunction with big media and government officials. It's completely contrary to the notion of realistic, real-based science.
And I'm glad you brought up, you've talked about it earlier, too, about how there's basically these two camps that have formed now. Either it was, lab leak, or it's absolutely crazy to even consider, still a conspiracy theory, to even discuss the possibility. And we can get more into this later, because I think that's really right. Dangerous to have that be the black and white here.
Absolutely.
Specifically because when you consider... that during COVID-19, there has just been an explosion, an incredibly risky gain of function research, supposedly as a way to research how to combat COVID-19. But Independent Science News, where some of your work has been published recently, published some Freedom of Information Act request documents showing that very risky research has been going on at places like the University of North Carolina that already had a release of a genetically engineered version of SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19, released. And that also the UPMC in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania has been trying to genetically combine SARS-CoV-2 with anthrax, supposedly to develop a vaccine candidate. But it just seems, these are just some examples. There's just really a huge proliferation of that going on at the moment. So to sort of basically discount the role that, gate of function plays overall, regardless of, the origin issue in and of itself, I think is pretty dangerous.
You're ahead of me on that.
We'll get there. Yeah. We can keep talking about Eco Health Alliance. I just wanted to bring it up in case I forgot later.
That is exactly what happened after, and we might go down this thread too. The anthrax attacks. That was the original impetus for a lot of this work.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've done a very good amount of work on this, and I think that it bears a lot more scrutiny in terms of what's actually going on here and what the parallels are and personnel and so on. There was a huge surge in funding of dangerous lab work after the anthrax attacks, which of course is incredibly mm-hmm. insidious and ironic because they came out of a U.S. or U.S. allied lab. Again, what I alluded to earlier, there was a concerted effort in the scientific community to object to this. In 2005, there was a letter by 700 scientists sort of pleading with the NIH to not, to stop this, funding that it was becoming too much and that it was deforming the field. And it was Fauci who responded at that point that basically told these scientists to put on their big boy pants. And what he said was, the American people have told us through their elected representatives, that's the Bush-Cheney administration he's talking about, that they want this work done, and it can either be done through other agencies, i.e. Pentagon, or it can be done through NIH. So he's in effect telling all of these scientists that if we want to have a seat at the table, that they should shut up with these concerns. So he was the enforcer on this. And has played an insidious role for literally decades.
Right. So I just want to wrap up on Eco Health Alliance then. One person that you've pointed out, who I've actually dug into a little bit in terms of his 2017 visit to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, is David Franz, do you mind talking a little bit about him and his connection to Eco Health Alliance and why that's important?
You might know more than I do, but what I know is that he's an advisor there, and he was at Fort Detrick, I think a very high official at Fort Detrick. He also, after the outbreak of the pandemic, wrote a piece with Judy Miller, who's the New York Times reporter, who was basically the only one who was called out for their Iraq WMD claims. She was just so brazen about it.
Mm-hmm.
Basically calling for an increase in funding, so-called gain-of-function lab work in Fort Detrick and so on. They wrote a piece together at the beginning of the pandemic. So that to me sets off a series of alarm bells. And what's interesting, the deep background with him, he Judy Miller still worked for the Times for a little bit after the Iraq invasion. And there was an article where she quotes him pushing the narrative that Iraq had these mobile weapons labs. It was like the last gasp of the establishment trying to hold on to the idea that the Iraq invasion was justified because Saddam had these hidden mobile weapon labs that we couldn't find somehow. And it was David Kelly, British scientist, who exposed that lie. And he was later, he later died in an alleged suicide that I believe a documentary is coming out and that's going to be scrutinizing whether or not it was
natural. Yeah, a lot of people believe that Kelly died under suspicious circumstances. And given what was going on at the time, it wouldn't be altogether too surprising. What I would like to add to that about David Franz is that Franz was one of a handful of Americans that went to inspect Iraq after the first Gulf War. Mm-hmm. Other people that went were Robert Kadlec, who I've written about considerably, mainly last year in the Engineering Contagion series, and William C. Patrick III, that if you read the third part of that series, which is mainly about Robert Kadlec, you will know that I think Patrick was probably the top suspect in the 2001 anthrax attacks of actually having been responsible for that, and that those that nexus in particular, those individuals who were tied to the military or the CIA or both, in the case of someone like William C. Patrick III, who also was a longtime figure at Fort Detrick as well, basically came up with this whole mobile lab thing as well to justify why they didn't find anything after making such a big fuss in the early 90s that Saddam Hussein had a large program that involved anthrax, which is why so many Gulf War veterans were injected with the anthrax vaccine, which was later linked by numerous people and studies to Gulf War syndrome. So obviously a bit controversial there for more than one reason. And as you mentioned, he teamed up with Judith Miller later on. But Judith Miller, in addition to citing Franz in the report you cited, I believe cites Franz considerably in her book Germs that came out right before the anthrax attacks. Of course, Judith Miller was a participant in the Dark Winter exercise where Robert Kadlec was also involved in writing the script, as were the people at the Johns Hopkins, what is now the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, previously the Johns Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Studies, I believe, who not only did Dark Winter, but also led Event 201, making them a bit controversial this time around as well. And for people that aren't familiar on Dark Winter, the first podcast episode of this series goes into it in great detail, but also I would refer you to the Engineering Contagion series, parts 1, 2, and 3, for more information on those things. But this is why, Franz, in terms of his ties to Eco Health Alliance, I think is interesting, because in 2017, he was part of a delegation that went to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And when he went there and was speaking to people at that institute, he outlined, among other things, possible joint project ideas with the military and U.S. academia, which included carrying out joint tabletop exercises or simulations of outbreaks, sort of like Dark Winter, essentially, but between the U.S., the different entities of the U.S. and the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and also spoke about decision-making surrounding gain-of-function research and, quote, overcoming barriers to sharing strain collections and transport of pathogens, which I think is pretty interesting. When you consider Franz's ties to people like Robert Kadlec, William C. Patrick III, and this whole group that had a lot of very shady connections regarding the anthrax attacks, and then, of course, his tie as an advisor to Eco Health Alliance and his own connection to Fort Detrick, which, by the way, as I mentioned earlier, for those that don't know, I wrote a piece in January 2020 that was my first piece ever published on The Last American Vagabond, where I talked about how, among other things, that there's actually a biosafety level 3 lab in Wuhan that's called the Wuhan Institute of Medical Virology. It's actually a part of a university that's a combination of Duke University in the U.S., which is a frequent contractor for DARPA, and also Wuhan University. And that Institute of Medical Virology in Wuhan is directly partnered with Fort Detrick and has been since the 80s. So I think that's pretty significant as well. When you consider that, you know, even though the Wuhan Institute of Virology for being biosafety level 4 has gotten most of the attention, with biosafety level 3, you can work with coronaviruses, including SARS and SARS-CoV-2, as well as anthrax and a lot of other pathogens. You can use CRISPR for gene editing at that level. So a lot of the, you know, possible techniques that are, you know, believed that in terms of gain of function that could have created something like, you know, SARS-CoV-2 in a lab were available to that other lab as well. And that hasn't been talked about hardly at all, which I think is kind of interesting as well.
That is interesting. I had seen some reporting about a BSL-2. I can't remember where. I think in one of the recent Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists pieces. I mean, Bulletin for the Atomic Scientists was just kind of scandalous in, you know, how long they took to get on the ball, but they have published some things that are somewhat useful. But I think they only talked about another BSL-2 and not the BSL-3 that you're talking about, and I don't think that I knew about the direct connection to 4.
Well, they listed on their website. I mean, hopefully it's still online. It was a way back. I way back machined it in January 2020. I mean, hopefully it's still there.
Alexis at Organic Consumer Association has noted that Qi Jing Li, the so-called bat lady at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, has, if not gotten DOD money, has co-authored at least 2, probably more pieces with people who have gotten DOD money.
Right. That's true.
So that there are connections there as well. So, I mean, all of the mantra is, you know, was the WIV connected to the Chinese military? And, you know, lately in major media, ABC has a big story about that recently. So I'm like, yeah, well, you know, maybe they do have a connection to the Chinese military, but they definitely have some kind of connection to the U.S. military.
Another thing I wanted to add to you about EcoHealth Alliance is this other thing that they're a part of called the Global Virome Project. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they're pretty interesting because it combines basically the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which, of course, was another main sponsor of Event 201, along with the John Hopkins people and the World Economic Forum, with EcoHealth Alliance, some of the top people at USAID's PREDICT program, which is one of the programs here that was involved in funding EcoHealth Alliance's work at the Wuhan Institute of Virology and in the region in general, but also Metabiota, which, if you're familiar with the work of Diljana Gotsenyeva, sorry if I'm butchering your last name again, Diljana, who writes at Arms Watch. She noted that Metabiota was one of the main contractors for the Lugar Center in Georgia that, you know, she did a lot of credible reporting about how they've been engaged in very nefarious experimentation on locals there and in biowarfare research. So it's interesting to see all of those people together at the Global Virome Project, which, interestingly enough, was set up at a meeting at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center, which is kind of interesting because the Rockefeller installations at Bellagio, Italy, is also what gave rise to the Club of Rome back several decades ago, and whose own origins are closely tied to those of the World Economic Forum. Just kind of interesting how many of these groups seem to connect there. But at this meeting that launched the Global Virome Project with all of these entities I just laid out, one of the people present was George Gao from the Chinese CDC, who was also a main speaker and participant at Event 201. And you also had a lot of people from the World Health Organization and the NIH. So interesting to see all of them together.
Right. The Global Virome Project is connected. It's like EcoHealth Alliance squared. The head of it, Carol, was...
Dennis Carol.
Was the guy at PREDICT. The program under USAID, which funded EcoHealth Alliance. Last I checked, Daszak was like treasurer of something of the Global Virome Project. They're linked, and Carol is now starting to get more media. I think because Daszak's name is such, you know, garbage. So they're sort of putting him forward. And I think what we're starting to see is this sort of spy versus spy. You know, on the one side, it's people like Daszak and Carol and so on who are, you know, closely allied with either the U.S. military, U.S. military and USAID, which, as you note, is a kind of quote unquote soft power, you know, cousin of the CIA. And on the other side are, you know, sort of some, you know, stripe of China basher. One person who's been getting out there a fair amount, the former Clinton administration official, Jamie Metzl. So, you know, they're going to attempt to constrain it so that it's either, so that both arms of the establishment get their way, right? One arm of the establishment wants to continue the dangerous lab work, and the other wants to use this as leverage against China. So they're effectively trying to, you know, do their dance as to how they can both get what they fundamentally want. And neither obviously is concerned about what the facts are, what the truth is, you know, preventing dangerous lab work and so on. They just simply want to exercise as much as possible of monopoly over it.
Right. So there's one more thing I want to add about EcoHealth Alliance, just because it ties in with, for people that are familiar in my work on, well, on Robert Kadlec specifically. For people that don't know who Robert Kadlec is, he was basically in charge of coronavirus response during the entire, or during the last year of the Trump administration, because he was the Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS's, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, which is actually a position that Robert Kadlec, beginning in the early 2000s, essentially created by drafting legislation over a series of decades, and then conveniently, with the onset of coronavirus, was in office right at that time, or in that particular position he had created right at that time, that gave him just an excessive amount of control over what vaccines would be funded, what therapeutics would be funded, PPE, just numerous, just an insane amount of control over coronavirus policy in the U.S. during that time, despite the fact that he's notoriously corrupt and has a lot of very shady connections that I encourage you to check out in that article. But in terms of a tie between him and EcoHealth Alliance, Robert Kadlec set up something that is now known as the Bipartisan Commission on Biodefense. It's basically a biodefense, quote unquote, think tank set up by Robert Kadlec in, I think, 2012, somewhere in that ballpark. But it's headed by Tom Ridge and Joe Lieberman, who are pretty hawkish, you know, in terms of one's a Republican, one's a Democrat. But, you know, if you're familiar with Lieberman, you'll know that he's basically John McCain for all intents and purposes. Anyway, William Koresh, who's the executive vice president for health and policy at EcoHealth Alliance, is a longtime member of that commission. Only I don't know exactly when he became an ex officio member. I think it was relatively recently, but he continues to be involved in that commission's dealings to some degree. Another ex officio member alongside William Koresh there is none other than Scooter Libby, Germ Boy himself, as he was called in the Bush administration for his obsession with biowarfare stuff, and also specifically with Dark Winter, who's now, he was also Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, but he's now on the executive team of the Hudson Institute, which funds this commission, and Koresh has attended Hudson Institute, I guess, talks about biodefense and COVID and all of this stuff with Lieberman and some other people. So beyond that, Koresh has a lot of ties to the UN, USAID, and he's also a CFR member. So it's interesting to see all of these ties there at EcoHealth Alliance. They're definitely very well connected, definitely very shady, and I really wish more people would be talking about these different aspects about them, including what you've covered. And actually, The Daily Caller covered some of your reporting on it not that long ago, not even bothering to link to your piece, linking to instead to the funding information you obtained so that no one can actually read the original source. Pretty sneaky of them. And of course, a lot of right-wing outlets that subsequently reported on the Daily Caller's quote-unquote new story cited them as the original source. Which is pretty unfortunate, but just shows, you know, just how journalism works more often than not these days.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been, you know, very frustrating to the degree that, you know, my reporting is being picked up. It's being, you know, sort of picked up very selectively by some right-wing outlets and being largely excluded from traditional allies. Another aspect of this in terms of commissions and so on, you have Philip Zelikow, who was the head of the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, setting up some kind of quasi-academic group, I think, at the University of Virginia in order to look into the origins. And what I fear might happen is that Congress might, in effect, hand any kind of investigation over to him in terms of the pandemic origins.
Yeah, and that's a disaster waiting to happen.
Right, and he would be the one to sort of arbitrate between the two arms of the establishment, the bioweapons establishment and the China bashing establishment, because that they effectively want to cut a deal together. I think that's a big thing to watch out for coming down the pike.
Yeah, was Peter Daszak added to that commission? Isn't he a member
of
Zelikow's thing? I think he may be.
I don't know about that.
Well, I know that he added some people with conflicts of interest. I think one of the people he added was Michael Callahan, who is a former DARPA lead, heavily USAID funded. I was in Wuhan in January 2020, was one of the first people on the cruise ships when all that was going on with the early COVID stuff. And definitely has a lot of conflicts of interest for other reasons. So I thought maybe Daszak might be there since he was, secretly the author of, I don't know if it was the Lancet, a Lancet piece dismissing the lab origin possibility last year. That was sort of his role in drafting that was hidden, among other things. So it wouldn't surprise me, but I'll have to go check up on that. Just to be sure. But it wouldn't surprise me to have someone like him on Zelikow's commission. And for people that aren't familiar with Philip Zelikow and the whole thing that happened with him and the 9/11 commission, his conflicts of interest in that regard, why he was likely put there, because you have to remember that the original person who was going to head the 9/11 commission was Henry Kissinger.
Right.
And then after people complained about that, they put in Philip Zelikow, who maybe wasn't as infamous as Kissinger, but really wasn't that much better at the end of the day. James Corbett, if you look for, on his site, stuff for Philip Zelikow, you'll definitely find, I think, more than one video dedicated to that man and his role in the 9/11 commission or cover-up, depending on how you look at those events. So, moving along, another article, Sam, that you wrote last year, came out last May. It discusses the long history of accidental lab releases of pathogens with pandemic potential. So from your research, how frequent are these events and how has this informed your opinions about the potential origins of such a possibility regarding COVID-19?
They're disturbingly frequent if you really look at it. And I was, startled to find how frequent when I was researching it after the pandemic started. It had been covered in the mainstream. At USA Today, Allison Young, a reporter there, did a whole series of articles in 2013, 2014 about that. And, she's again one of these people who was incredibly silent last year, but she started doing some interesting reporting now. But of course, she's going to frame it as, accidental along with the rest of the major media at this juncture. But it could well be what happened, and it certainly has happened in the past. And not only, SARS, for example, is still widely thought to be, and I don't have any information to the contrary, to be of natural origin, but it was released accidentally through labs two or three times after the outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been numerous others. There was an N1H1 virus that was released, I believe, in the 1950s or 60s, and did major damage, and the reporting that I've been able to find on it sort of came to the conclusion that the scientific community sort of you know, swept it under the rug because they didn't want to increase tensions between U.S. and Russian scientists. Allegedly, that was the alleged reason. In an old Bolton Atomic Scientists article on the subject. So both things have happened, both many numerous lab leaks as well as the scientific community coalescing in order to sweep the possibility of lab origin under the rug, have a long and dangerous history.
Yeah, when I was writing about the anthrax attacks last year, in considerable detail, and considering everything that's been going on now, I was really surprised to learn that in the aftermath of that, I think between 2005 and 2015, it may have even been longer because they only started counting it, but there were like hundreds of occasions on when anthrax was shipped around different army facilities throughout the U.S. without the proper containment for it. Mm-hmm. And considering what happened with the anthrax attacks and the mail system and all of that, I mean, that's really scandalous. And it happened like hundreds of times until it was found in a government accountability office report, if I'm not mistaken. I'll have to go double check on exactly who found it out. But I mean, that's just totally insane. The lack of care in treating these kinds of pathogens. And that came up in a big way last year for Fort Detrick specifically, which if you believe the official story anyway about the anthrax attacks, is supposed to be the source of the anthrax used in that attack. Though if you read my series, there definitely are some other possibilities, like Battelle's West Jefferson facility. And some people think the Dugway facility in Utah may have been involved. Basically, last year, in July, I think it was, Fort Detrick was forced to shut down.
Right.
And for a series of violations. But two of those issues involved two breaches of containment of pathogens that we don't know what they are. A Twitter account who's really great. I recommend everyone follow him. Gumby4Christ, the number four, has done a lot of work on this stuff and obtained the Freedom of Information Act documents regarding the this incident at Fort Detrick last year specifically, and they redact the names of the pathogens involved. But the safety lapses and breaches at Fort Detrick found in this instance were considerable and very, very unsettling for, you know, a variety of reasons, not just, you know, that it may have had some potential role in the weird respiratory illnesses that were going around nursing homes and other places during this time that were later blamed on the so-called vaping illness that, you know, disappeared once COVID-19 was really on the scene. You know, a lot of people have speculated about that. It's really hard to know exactly what was going on. But it is interesting to see sort of the military involvement at places like Wuhan. And then, of course, similar things going on in terms of, you know, possible lapses of safety that could have resulted in something being released. Also going on in a U.S. military bioweapon or biodefense facilities in the U.S. So I don't know if you've looked into those that breach or those issues at Fort Detrick specifically, but what I found really striking about it is that Congress wasn't notified. They actually learned about it. Local senators in Maryland and congressmen from Maryland learned about it from the reporting of, I think, the local outlet in Fredericksburg, Maryland, that covered the fact that it had been shut down. So that's pretty significant that even Congress hadn't been notified that Fort Detrick had been shut down. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I haven't pursued it substantially. I know that there are some activists in the area, Barry Christen, who's a lawyer, and I believe that he's trying to follow on that. I was just looking at, you know, they put the pause of gain of function work on in 2014, and that was largely attributed to the reporting of large scale accidental releases and so on at labs. It was also the time of the Ebola outbreak as well. And I was just looking at an old video of Francis Collins, the NIH, you know, talking about how they even found spores that they didn't know that they had of smallpox I think they're only supposed to have one thing of smallpox, which, you know, I mean, arguably they shouldn't have, but they actually found, you know, some of the most deadly pathogens in storage cases and so on that they didn't know they had. So the possibilities here for accidental or quote-unquote unauthorized release and so on are too, you know, numerous to calculate. So right. all of the rhetoric about, you know, China needs to disclose, China needs to be transparent and so on, all of that, you know, goes doubly to U.S. facilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth pointing out, too, that a lot of these safety lapses, including the one last year at Fort Detrick, you know, at Fort Detrick specifically, this has been like a multi-decade long issue for Fort Detrick. If you go back and you read the first article on my Engineering Contagion series, All Roads Lead to Dark Winter, it starts with the story about Philip Zack, who gained unauthorized access to Fort Detrick to do research on anthrax and other pathogens. Some of the vials containing pathogens just went missing, and no one noticed until there was an investigation like a year or two later. A lot of shady stuff going on back then. And, you know, after engaging in that type of activity, Philip Zack was allowed to continue collaborating with U.S. government researchers, and it later went on to head a special investigative research department at Gilead right after Donald Rumsfeld left being head of Gilead to be Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration. So just pretty interesting and a pretty illustrative example about how there's really been no accountability for this kind of stuff in the U.S. for a very long time, and that the proliferation of gain of function research since then has just really exploded, as you mentioned earlier, developing in a huge way after the anthrax attacks. But now with COVID-19, you could argue that it's another explosion on that scale, potentially larger even, with even more potentially dangerous forms of biotechnology being used.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think it's easy enough to say, regardless of the origins, you need to, you know, stop or seriously scrutinize so-called gain-of-function work at this point. I mean, you could make an analogy to you know, climate. You can't say, you know, this, you know, factory or you know, burning this set of fossil fuels caused that hurricane. You know, it's a complex system, obviously. But you can say that, you know, burning fossil fuels increases the likelihood of, you know, climate disruption. So I think it's a fairly simple thing to say that continuing this level and nature of dangerous biolab work dramatically increases the possibilities of deadly pathogens. I mean, what they're kind of trying to do is sort of get ahead of that's the ostensible reason. They're getting ahead of nature. They're getting ahead of the terrorists coming up with deadly pathogens. But it's like, to solve an alleged problem, they are taking dramatically greater risks, right? It's like, you know, I covered the Plowshares trial in Georgia in 2019, and that was very educational in how the government manipulated information in that courtroom. But part of the dynamics of that was these activists went to this Trident nuclear facility, which is the main hub of these Trident submarines that go to the, you know, shores of Russia, sit there, and it's so insidious because in order to defend, quote unquote, the United States from potential nuclear attack from Russia, they sit there off the shore of Russia, effectively making the Russians on a hair trigger alert. So that, you know, dramatically increasing the possibilities of a accidental launch, because the Russians, you know, got whatever it is, 12 minutes to decide whether or not this is an actual attack or not. So it's sort of a similar thing going on here, or the whole war on terror thing. We've got to intervene in order to solve the problem. The solution is the disease. The solution is making the threat more dangerous. That's what so-called gain of function work is doing. And it's a very militarized mindset. I think that's a huge, it's actually going back to the Eco-Health Alliance. I actually found a quote from Peter Daszak in a talk that he gave with Jeffrey Sachs, where he actually cites very positively Donald Rumsfeld's "There are no knowns, known unknowns." Does that quote? And he says, "What a genius!" You know, it's exactly the same.
Oh my gosh!
With the you know,
why does anyone trust this guy?
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's scary.
Dealing with terrorists the way that Rumsfeld did allegedly.
Yeah, is exactly making up lies to justify invading. Yeah. All right, man. That I didn't know that. That's pretty disconcerting on multiple levels. Some guy saying that Rumsfeld's a hero for his the terrorist could be anywhere type of mentality. That's definitely not good. Anyway, one thing that I think is important to throw in here in talking about gain of function is that generally, at least publicly, one of the main justifications and probably one of the biggest obstacles into sort of reducing the amount of this research that's done in the U.S. and more broadly globally is that gain of function research is justified as being necessary for the development of vaccines and therapeutics, specifically medical countermeasures for the, a potential future pandemic or bioterrorist attack, right? So as an example of that type of statement being made, there's this guy, W. Paul Dupree, I think, or it's spelled Duprex, but I assumed his last name was like Dupree or something. I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce it. But anyway, he's a DARPA-funded scientist. He used to be a chief scientist at Johnson & Johnson. He currently runs the Center for Vaccine Research at UPMC in Pittsburgh. And he stated in a 2014 Nature paper that gain of function approaches are absolutely essential in infectious disease research. Although alternative approaches can be very useful, they can never replace gain of function experiments, end quote. And then he goes on to add that there are only two reasons for gain of function research. The first being, quote, to improve surveillance or to develop therapeutics, end quote, like vaccines specifically, which is this, what the center of that he runs develops specifically are vaccines. And the second being merely to learn, quote, interesting biology. So, of course, the latter point, with gain of function under scrutiny now, is a much harder sell. But saying that you need it to improve surveillance, which is something that EcoHealth Alliance likes to involve themselves in, or the development of vaccines, I think, the pharmaceutical industry angle there makes it a much harder issue to tackle, because then you're adding, in the interest of a very powerful component of the private sector there as well. So what do you make of this fact that a lot of gain of function proponents and scientists frame this really risky research as being necessary to combating a pandemic, even though it could potentially cause one?
Ebright at Rutgers claims that there's been no documented case of gain-of-function work actually coming up with something useful. I haven't investigated that directly. It's just simply come up with deadly pathogens, and it never seems to get to the point of actually solving the problem that it creates. So it seems to just simply be what Francis Boyle has been alleging, a pretext. In order, you say that you have to develop something dangerous so that you can allegedly defend against it, but you never get to the defending against it part. So it's just simply
a loophole.
It's a fake pretext for. I mean, Boyle doesn't argue that it's not really a loophole, because in his he claims that they're just outright violating the law that he wrote and the Bioweapons Convention, that they're pretending that there's a loophole when there isn't, because the convention and the law don't say that there's it uses the word peaceful purposes. It doesn't say defensive purposes. It says peaceful purposes. So that means that you can't be doing this. If it said defensive, then you could argue what they're arguing, but the word defensive isn't in the treaty.
Well, there's several, you know, for decades they've been trying to get around the wording of that. If I'm not mistaken, not that long before the anthrax attacks themselves took place, the Bush administration rejected signing some sort of international document that would have forced them to be in compliance with that convention, saying that regular inspections of U.S. defense facilities or contractor facilities engaged in that type of research would potentially lead to a loss of trade secrets or something like that. But then, of course, a couple months later, one of those facilities was the source of the anthrax used in the 2001 anthrax attack. So that's pretty interesting. And to go back to those attacks, the alleged main reason the Bush administration rejected this is because of the experiments, the Pentagon-funded experiments to genetically engineer a more dangerous form of anthrax, allegedly to improve emergent biosolution, then known as Bioport's anthrax vaccine, at Battelle's West Jefferson facility that involved Ken Allebeck, who I might bring up later, and William C. Patrick III, who was pals with David Franz and Robert Kablik, among other people.
I'd like to get, you know, I'd like to know more about why you think Patrick is the one behind the anthrax attacks, but I want to chime in. That law that Boyle wrote passed, I think, unanimously, which was kind of remarkable. I think around 1989, 1990, and it was done with the Council for Responsible Genetics, which has since gone under, and that's part of the problem. All of the groups that, you know, would have looked at, or most of the groups, that would have looked at the dangers of biolab work have gone under because of, I assume, lack of funding. But what's really fascinating, and this is somewhat speculative on my part, it was very advantageous to get that law passed prior to the Gulf War because it helped the U.S. both posture in terms of attacking Iraq and to purge the Bush administration, to purge any U.S. officials that might have been tacit allies of Saddam Hussein in order to stand in the way of the Iraq invasion. So I believe that even the United States, finally implementing that treaty, which Nixon had signed in 1972, was itself, it may have been a Machiavellian maneuver in order to, facilitate, coalescing the establishment for the Iraq invasion. But that's somewhat, that's just simply a question in my mind. The entire notion of, the gain of function work, I mean, as damaging as coronavirus has been and so on. I mean, I've seen estimates that if the avian flu gets out in its weaponized form, from the scientists in the Netherlands and the University of Wisconsin funded by the NIH, we're talking about more than 1 billion people dead. That's the level of threat, that we're, potentially, talking about. So the risks are enormous, and the failures are both in the media sphere and in the legal sphere and in the political sphere. And so, if you want to call them, failures, maybe they're successes. If you don't want to keep going down this path, but that I mean, even part of the motive, I think, societally of, only coming to terms with this is that if the lab origin was seriously discussed more than a year ago when it should have been, we would have seen a concerted global effort to stop it. And we're not. Now it's a plaything of elites rather than the potential of a mass, global public revulsion as to what the scientific and military and media establishment has wrought. So I think that's part of the
dynamic. Right. Well, I think another issue, I sort of touched on this a little bit ago, of why, gain of function is unlikely to be touched by mainstream media specifically, is because there is a big interest there of the vaccine industry to keep it going. Mm-hmm. For some of the reasons I laid out before. But also, I mean, you can see this in the Engineering Contagion series too, about the anthrax vaccine, justifying the anthrax research that was going on. There's a lot of scientists that are and politicians and other individuals that are very invested in the network as it is today, you know, continuing to function as is. And given the involvement of the vaccine industry specifically, you know, we've seen over the past year just the type of censorship and treatment of people who are critical of that. Right. Particularly with the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, you know, people that follow my work know that I was deplatformed from Patreon for critical reporting on the AstraZeneca vaccine that's now been banned in like 20 countries and is, you know, increasingly, you know, I think Canada just said that they weren't going to be using it anymore, and some other countries have followed as well. So, you know, that type of censorship is not obviously not in the public interest, because I think the debate about whether AstraZeneca was safe should have happened before the rollout, with concerns like mine and other. I wasn't the only one raising concerns about that particular vaccine candidate at the time. But, you know, this should have happened then and not after the fact. Right. When there were obvious concerns that needed to be addressed before the rollout. Right. And so, you know, the fact that we can't. At this point in time, really effectively question the vaccine industry, period, without being labeled anti-vaccine, you know, their involvement to a large degree with a lot of this gain of function stuff and in funding it, or, you know, the scientists that, you know, some of the scientists that are engaged in this are funded by Big Pharma or previously worked for Big Pharma, among other things. You know, there's definitely an angle there that is likely to keep it in place unless, you know, more people get vocal about the dangers this presents to global health. But anyway, I want to move on, if that's okay, in the interest of time. I do have one more question. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the story or not. But there have been recent reports that a high-ranking Chinese intelligence official has defected to the U.S. recently and has been working with the Defense Intelligence Agency. His name is apparently Dong Jingwei. He's allegedly given troves of info to the U.S. government on the Wuhan Institute of Virology and other bio-warfare, bio-defense programs being overseen by the Chinese government. So, you know, I don't really doubt that the Chinese government engages in this stuff, because the U.S. government does, and I'm sure, you know, in keeping up with a sort of, you know, as a sort of an arms race type of thing, it would make sense the Chinese government would fund this research. I mean, they fund it alongside the U.S. at places like the Wuhan Institute of Virology, you know, but I am skeptical about this official, because from descriptions of him and his story, he seems a lot like Ken Allebeck, who I mentioned just a little bit ago. And if you're not familiar with Allebeck, he was the former head of Soviet biowarfare research, who defected to the U.S. right before the fall of the USSR. He was, you know, debriefed by the CIA and later ended up heading the bioweapons program at Battelle West Jefferson facility during that Pentagon-funded gain-of-function research on anthrax before the anthrax attacks with William Patrick. And Allebeck and Patrick were both, in my opinion, totally crazy people. and I say this for good reason. There's, I think, in 1997, a New Yorker piece written about Allebeck and Patrick, because Patrick used to be the main anthrax guy at Fort Detrick. He has 5 classified patents, or had, he's dead now. 5 classified patents on the weaponization of anthrax, and developed the original way it was aerosolized and weaponized by Fort Detrick decades ago. But in that New Yorker article, he and Allebeck are looking down on the town of Fredericksburg, Maryland, and just casually saying, well, you know, if it were up to me today, what mix of deadly pathogens would you use to release on the town down there? And they're like, and then I think Patrick was asking Ken Allebeck, and Ken Allebeck responds, oh, Marburg virus and smallpox. And then they like laugh about it. And the journalist writing this was like, this is normal. No, it's not normal. That's really freaky. But, you know, it turned out Allebeck, you know, he was used throughout the 1990s and even in the early 2000s to lead up to the Iraq war. He claimed that Saddam Hussein had a very advanced biowarfare program that turned out to be false. And he also got caught basically making up a bunch of stuff that was just stuff that he thought, you know, the Cold Warriors and the U.S. government wanted to hear. And it was really successful for a long time, but he later got called out for it, but, you know, not before doing a lot of damage. So the narrative thus far about this Chinese official is looking at placing, you know, the blame squarely on the Chinese government for a potential lab origin of COVID-19. And we've already discussed about how that's an obvious limited hangout. So I was wondering what your thoughts on that may be.
Yeah, I mean, the whole structure of the media coverage lately has been, you know, the U.S. were duped by the Chinese, like Daszak, you know, and company, and Fauci were duped by the Chinese. I think that that's preposterous. They drove.
I agree.
They really drove it. I mean, if you look at her statements, Xi Jinping, the so-called bat lady, you know, she was, you know, she said that she told Scientific American, I couldn't sleep for 3 days, you know, because I was wondering if it came out of our lab, and then I did all these tests, and I couldn't find that we had it. So, I mean, she could be telling the truth there. I don't know. Again, there are three main possibilities. It had nothing to do with a lab, looking less and less likely, but still a logical possibility. It was an accident coming out of the Chinese lab, in which case, and that would be explained by the Chinese basically trying to keep up with the U.S. in this dangerous lab work, or they're being framed, or it's some kind of intentional release. And a leading possibility in that third option is that somebody is framing the Chinese labs. So, you know, that's those are the main things, and they need to be separated out. And we need to talk about lab origin and not lab leak. Sorry, I had something else.
Well, in terms of that last possibility, I want to bring up again this David Franz visit, where he emphasized the need to collaborate more. And there's actually been a lot of national security linked officials over the years, and sort of in the space, that have criticized China for not being willing enough to share pathogens and different strain collections and things like that with the U.S. government. And this is something David Franz said directly when he visited the Wuhan Institute of Virology just a couple of years ago, talking about gain of function and how they weren't sharing their strain collections and transporting pathogens enough. If they were, so in terms of that third possibility, a potential motive, if that is the case, I think would be, you know, did they not collaborate enough? And is this a way to get them to collaborate more as we enter this crazy gain of function realm in the COVID era? And, you know, there's been people like Bill Gates and other people that have ha-ha'd about the possibility of a pandemic too, as Bill Gates called it, which could easily, you know, in this climate of extreme gain of function going on now under the guise of combating COVID-19, could easily, you know, be the case once again. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Just on the attitude towards the Chinese, there are two, I think, parallels that we need to keep in mind. One is Iraq and what happened in Iraq in the 1990s, where UNSCOM, you know, allegedly attempting to investigate the existence of Iraq's allegedly having WMDs, was basically used as a pretext to, strangle Iraq to death, and then for war. I'm sure that that's a consideration and a threat on both the U.S. and the Chinese part, that you know, if there's some kind of instrument that the U.S. can use to leverage against China in terms of investigating it and so on. I mean, I want to get to the bottom of it, but I'm also highly concerned that the U.S. establishment is going to use it, through some mechanism as a way of demonizing China in the same way that UNSCOM was used. The other possibility, which just came to mind for me yesterday, was, I don't know if you're familiar with the whole Merlin project.
No, I'm not.
It had to do with Iran, and it was basically a U.S. cyber attack that attempted to, not quite a cyber attack, but it was a covert operation that effectively try to plant a nuclear gun on Iran. That is to give them nuclear technology that can then be used as a pretext against them. So I think that that's, you know, a parallel and a possibility that we need to keep in mind as to what's going on here. That is, you know, was the whole DASAC operation and company a way of getting China a level of technology that could then be planted and then used against them? The U.S. has a long history of turning, you know, of being an alleged ally or collaborator with people and then turning on them in some fashion. So I think that's another possibility that we need to keep in mind if we're going to try to sort through methodically. I mean, we may never get to the truth of what caused this, but what we can do is get to the truth as to who the liars are and break it down as you're doing. And I think that can be incredibly invaluable in this dangerous time.
Well, as far as I see, you know, the possibilities with China here, I think it's important to keep in mind that there's a couple different factions in the U.S. establishment today. So, of course, you have the China Hawks. And, you know, for anyone that wants to know about that decades-long agenda, the PNAC people, Project for a New American Century, and the neocons and all of that have been very explicit about targeting China for decades. And if anyone's familiar with John Pilger's documentary, The Coming War on China, sort of this effort to militarize the space around China in order to prepare for some sort of future war, it's very well documented. And of course, you know, a lot of these, figures in the U.S. that are all about maintaining U.S. military hegemony into the foreseeable future at any and all costs, are very open about that at some point there's going to be some sort of major conflict with China, whatever that is. But at the same time, you also have a lot of prominent, businessmen, I guess you could call them, who are also very well connected to the intelligence communities in the Pentagon, people like Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, and Steve Schwartzman of Blackstone Capital. And of course, you know, I think there's people in the Biden administration that probably fit this bill as well. And Henry Kissinger is also, even though he's not in politics anymore, is an influential voice in this camp as well, saying that the U.S. needs to collaborate more closely with China as a way to avert this war. Given what's happened with the Wuhan thing, was this a way to push China into that collaboration camp promoted by that one particular faction, or is this to frame them in the push for war by the China Hawks? Like you said, it's going to be really hard to know exactly what the case is, but I suppose time will tell as to whether, you know, that we go on a more militaristic path with China policy, or there's this more collaborative behind the scenes effort to, basically collaborate on a lot of very Orwellian policies of interest to both the U.S. and the Chinese government. And more globalist organizations like the World Economic Forum and what have you. But I think, you know, it remains to be seen. But definitely the origins of COVID-19, I think, play into that and would, if we could get to the bottom of it, would elucidate sort of what the strategy was from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that the two may work hand in hand. And I don't, you know, I'm trying not to go into a, you know, wait and see thing. I think we need to, you know, is what we're doing here, intervening in the process, because neither of these camps want to get at the truth or protect the general public. They won't want to pursue their own agendas, and they could well use. I mean, if the U.S. establishment could prove that it came out of the Wuhan lab, I don't know that they would disclose that right away. They would use it as leverage. I think we need to be, you know, careful as to how we sort it out. I think that they can, you know, use the threat of use of force or some other set of threats for their own advantage rather than, it could end up, as Pilger has argued, outright war, or it could just simply be, you know, you're a junior partner in the global system that we, you know, are supreme in. But the two things can cooperate, go hand in hand. And the whole, you know, China, anti-China, you know, I mean, there's the PNAC crowd, but there's the whole Asian pivot thing was an Obama-Biden thing.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. I've long sensed that Biden has a deep, I don't know if I'd quite call it an animus, but, he has long been oriented towards what he would say is the China challenge, that, you know, the U.S. and China are the, you know, two main civilizations that, you know, regard themselves as, you know, the center, you know, as, you know, supreme. And that therefore China poses a unique, quote unquote, challenge to U.S. dominance. So, there's absolutely a lot of pieces to this. And I think that we should, as much as possible, you know, in a good way, use these camps against each other. Not to accelerate towards war, but to force further and further disclosure and, you know, you use the contradictions to try to get at the truth.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up then, Sam, if that's okay, because we've already gone a little over an hour and a half, and that's usually where I end up having to cut off podcasts more often than not. But I think that was a really great discussion. So,
thank you so much.
People, after listening to this, will be interested to follow your work. I understand that you have an upcoming piece. So if you want to drop a little hint about what that is about, when people can expect it, where to find it and follow your work and support your work in general, that would be great.
I should stay mum on that, but I really do hope that people will follow it. It may well be in the next week with Independent Science News, where I've been writing lately, and I hope to be cranking out more stuff from my webpage, husseini.org, HUSSEINI.org, and I may well be joining the land of Substack to see if that's a productive mechanism of getting information out. So so stay tuned for that.
Okay, great. So thanks everyone for tuning into this important discussion about yet another narrative being co-opted by the establishment, and that is hiding a lot of really important information about what we've been experiencing in the past year and a half or so.